On California Island. In 1510, the Spanish writer Garci Rodriguez de Montalvo published a swashbuckling, Odyssey-like novel, The Exploits of Esplandian, which included a description of a vast island called California. On the right hand from the Indies exists an island called California, very close to a side of the earthly paradise, and it was populated by black women, without any man existing there, because they lived in the way of the Amazons. They had beautiful and robust bodies, and were brave and very strong. Their island was the strongest of the world, with its cliffs and rocky shores. Their weapons were golden, and so were the harnesses of the wild beasts that they were accustomed to domesticate and ride, because there was no other metal in the island than gold. Rumors of gold propelled the legend of the island of California across Europe, prompting adventurers throughout the continent to set off in search of it. Hernán Cortés, the Spanish conquistador who led the colonization of the Americas, requested money from Spain's king to lead a worldwide hunt. And when he landed in what we now know as Baja California in 1536, he was certain he'd found the place. It wasn't until one of his navigators, Francisco de Ulloa, traveled up the Gulf of California to the mouth of the Colorado River that it became clear to Cortés that, gold or no, he hadn't found the mythical island. Despite this discovery, however, the idea that California was an island persisted for several more centuries. Other explorers discovered Puget Sound near Vancouver and were certain that it must connect to Baja. Dutch maps from the 1600s routinely show a distended long fragment off the coast of America stretching half the length of the continent. It took Jesuit missionaries literally marching inland and never reaching the other side to fully repudiate the myth. It may have persisted for one simple reason. There was no sign on the maps for "don't know," and so the distinction between geographic guesswork and sites that had been witnessed firsthand became blurred. One of history's major cartographic errors, the island of California, reminds us that it's not what we don't know that hurts us as much as what we don't know, what ex-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld famously called the unknown unknowns. This is one other way that personalized filters can interfere with our ability to properly understand the world. They alter our sense of the map. More unsettling, they often remove its blank spots, transforming known unknowns into unknown ones. Traditional, unpersonalized media often offer the promise of representativeness. A newspaper editor isn't doing his or her job properly unless, to some degree, the paper is representative of the news of the day. This is one of the ways one can convert an unknown unknown into a known unknown. If you leaf through the paper, dipping into some articles and skipping over most of them, you at least know there are stories, perhaps whole sections, that you passed over. Even if you don't read the article, you notice the headline about a flood in Pakistan, or maybe you're just reminded that, yes, there is a Pakistan. In the filter bubble, things look different. You don't see the things that don't interest you at all. You're not even latently aware that there are major events and ideas you're missing. Nor can you take the links you do see and assess how representative they are without an understanding of what the broader environment from which they were selected looks like. As any statistician will tell you, you can't tell how biased the sample is from looking at the sample alone. You need something to compare it to. As a last resort, you might look at your selection and ask yourself if it looks like a representative sample. Are there conflicting views? Are there different takes and different kinds of people reflecting? Even this is a blind alley, however, because with an information set the size of the internet, you get a kind of fractal diversity. At any level, even within a very narrow information spectrum, atheist goth bowlers say, there are lots of voices and lots of different takes. We're never able to experience the whole world at once, but the best information tools give us a sense of where we stand in it. literally in the case of a library and figuratively in the case of a newspaper front page. This was one of the CIA's primary errors with Yuri Nosenko. The agency had collected a specialized subset of information about Nosenko without realizing how specialized it was, and thus, despite the many brilliant analysts working for years on the case, it missed what would have been obvious from a whole picture of the man. Because personalized filters usually have no zoom-out function, it's easy to lose your bearings, to believe the world is a narrow island when in fact it's an immense, varied continent. 4. The U-Loop. I believe this is the quest for what a personal computer really is. It is to capture one's entire life. Gordon Bell. You have one identity, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg told journalist David Kirkpatrick for his book, The Facebook Effect. The days of you having a different image for your work friends or coworkers and for the other people you know are probably coming to an end pretty quickly. Having two identities for yourself is an example of a lack of integrity. A year later, soon after the book had been published, 26-year-old Zuckerberg sat on stage with Kirkpatrick and NPR interviewer Guy Raz at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. In David's book, Raz said, "You say that people should have one identity, but I behave a different way around my family than I do around my colleagues." Zuckerberg shrugged. "No, I think that was just a sentence," I said. Raz continued, "Are you the same person right now as when you're with your friends?"
Yeah, Zuckerberg said.
"Same awkward self." If Mark Zuckerberg were a standard mid-20-something, this tangle of views might be par for the course. Most of us don't spend too much time musing philosophically about the nature of identity. But Zuckerberg controls the world's most powerful and widely used technology for managing and expressing who we are, and his views on the matter are central to his vision for the company and for the Internet. Speaking at an event during New York's Ad Week, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg said she expected the Internet to change quickly. "People don't want something targeted to the whole world. They want something that reflects what they want to see and know," she said, suggesting that in 3 to 5 years, that would be the norm. Facebook's goal is to be at the center of that process, the singular platform through which every other service and website incorporates your personal and social data. You have one identity. It's your Facebook identity, and it colors your experience everywhere you go. It's hard to imagine a more dramatic departure from the early days of the Internet, in which not exposing your identity was part of the appeal. In chat rooms and online forums, your gender, race, age, and location were whatever you said they were, and the denizens of these spaces exulted about the way the medium allowed you to shed your skin. Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, founder John Perry Barlow dreamed of creating a world that all may enter without privilege or prejudice accorded by race, economic power, military force, or station of birth. The freedom that this offered anyone who was interested to transgress and explore, to try on different personas for size, felt revolutionary. As law and commerce have caught up with technology, however, the space for anonymity online is shrinking. You can't hold an anonymous person responsible for his or her actions. Anonymous customers commit fraud. Anonymous commenters start flame wars, and anonymous hackers cause trouble. To establish the trust that community and capitalism are built on, you need to know whom you're dealing with. As a result, there are dozens of companies working on de-anonymizing the web. Peak U, a firm founded by the creator of RateMyProfessors.com, is patenting ways of connecting online activities done under a pseudonym with the real name of the person involved. Another company, Form, helps Internet service providers use a method called deep packet inspection to analyze the traffic that flows through their servers. Form aims to build nearly comprehensive profiles of each customer to use for advertising and personalized services. And if ISPs are leery, Blue Kava is compiling a database of every computer, smartphone, and online-enabled gadget in the world, which can be tied to the individual people who use them. Even if you're using the highest privacy settings in your web browser, in other words, your hardware may soon give you away. These technological developments pave the way for a more persistent kind of personalization than anything we've experienced to date. It also means that we'll increasingly be forced to trust the companies at the center of this process to properly express and synthesize who we really are. When you meet someone in a bar or a park, you look at how they behave and act and form an impression accordingly. Facebook and the other identity services aim to mediate that process online. If they don't do it right, things can get fuzzy and distorted. To personalize well, you have to have the right idea of what represents a person. There's another tension in the interplay of identity and personalization. Most personalized filters are based on a three-step model. First, you figure out who people are and what they like. Then, you provide them with content and services that best fit them. Finally, you tune to get the fit just right. Your identity shapes your media. There's just one flaw in this logic. Media also shape identity. And as a result, these services may end up creating a good fit between you and your media by changing you. If a self-fulfilling prophecy is a false definition of the world that through one's actions becomes true, we're now on the verge of self-fulfilling identities in which the Internet's distorted picture of us becomes who we really are. Personalized filtering can even affect your ability to choose your own destiny. In Of Sirens and Amish Children, a much-cited tract, information law theorist Yochai Benkler describes how more diverse information sources make us freer. Autonomy, Benkler points out, is a tricky concept. To be free, you have to be able not only to do what you want, but to know what's possible to do. The Amish children in the title are plaintiffs in a famous court case, Wisconsin v. Yoder, whose parents sought to prevent them from attending public school so they wouldn't be exposed to modern life. Benkler argues that this is a real threat to the children's freedom. Not knowing that it's possible to be an astronaut is just as much a prohibition against becoming one as knowing and being barred from doing so. Of course, too many options are just as problematic as too few. You can find yourself overwhelmed by the number of options or paralyzed by the paradox of choice. But the basic point remains. The filter bubble doesn't just reflect your identity. It also illustrates what choices you have. Students who go to Ivy League colleges see targeted advertisements for jobs that students at state schools are never even aware of. The personal feeds of professional scientists might feature articles about contests that amateurs never become aware of. By illustrating some possibilities and blocking out others, the filter bubble has a hand in your decisions. And in turn, it shapes who you become. A bad theory of you. The way that personalization shapes identity is still becoming clear, especially because most of us still spend more time consuming broadcast media than personalized content streams. But by looking at how the major filterers think about identity, it's becoming possible to predict what these changes might look like. Personalization requires a theory of what makes a person, of what bits of data are most important to determine who someone is, and the major players on the web have quite different ways of approaching the problem. Google's filtering systems, for example, rely heavily on web history and what you click on, click signals, to infer what you like and dislike. These clicks often happen in an entirely private context. The assumption is that searches for intestinal gas and celebrity gossip websites are between you and your web browser. You might behave differently if you thought other people were going to see your searches. But it's that behavior that determines what content you see in Google News, what ads Google displays, what determines, in other words, Google's theory of you. The basis for Facebook's personalization is entirely different. While Facebook undoubtedly tracks clicks, its primary way of thinking about your identity is to look at what you share and with whom you interact. That's a whole different kettle of data from Google's. There are plenty of prurient, vain, and embarrassing things we click on that we'd be reluctant to share with all of our friends in a status update. And the reverse is true, too. I'll cop to sometimes sharing links I've barely read, the long investigative piece on the reconstruction of Haiti, the bold political headline, because I like the way it makes me appear to others. The Google self and the Facebook self, in other words, are pretty different people. There's a big difference between you are what you click and you are what you share. Both ways of thinking have their benefits and drawbacks. With Google's click-based self, the gay teenager who hasn't come out to his parents can still get a personalized Google News feed with pieces from the broader gay community that affirm that he's not alone. But by the same token, a self built on clicks will tend to draw us even more toward the items we're predisposed to look at already, toward our most Pavlovian selves. Your perusal of an article on TMZ.com is filed away, and the next time you're looking at the news, Brad Pitt's marriage drama is more likely to flash on the screen. If Google didn't persistently downplay porn, the problem would presumably be far worse. Facebook's share-based self is more aspirational. Facebook takes you more at your word, presenting you as you'd like to be seen by others. Your Facebook self is more of a performance, less of a behaviorist black box, and ultimately, it may be more pro-social than the bundle of signals Google tracks. But the Facebook approach has its downsides as well. To the extent that Facebook draws on the more public self, it necessarily has less room for private interests and concerns. The same closeted gay teenager's information environment on Facebook might diverge more from his real self. The Facebook portrait remains incomplete. Both are pretty poor representations of who we are, in part because there is no one set of data that describes who we are. Information about our property, our professions, our purchases, our finances, and our medical history does not tell the whole story, writes privacy expert Daniel Solove. We are more than the bits of data we give off as we go about our lives. Digital animators and robotics engineers frequently run into a problem known as the uncanny valley. The uncanny valley is the place where something is lifelike, but not convincingly alive, and it gives people the creeps. It's part of why digital animation of real people still hasn't hit the big screens. When an image looks almost like a real person, but not quite, it's unsettling on a basic psychological level. We're now in the uncanny valley of personalization. The doppelganger selves reflected in our media are a lot like, but not exactly, ourselves. And, as we'll see, there are some important things that are lost in the gap between the data and reality. To start with, Zuckerberg's statement that we have one identity simply isn't true. Psychologists have a name for this fallacy, fundamental attribution error. We tend to attribute people's behavior to their inner traits and personality rather than to the situations they're placed in. Even in situations where the context clearly plays a major role, we find it hard to separate how someone behaves from who she is. And to a striking degree, our characteristics are fluid. Someone who's aggressive at work may be a doormat at home. Someone who's gregarious when happy may be introverted when stressed. Even some of our closest held traits, our disinclination to do harm, for example, can be shaped by context. Groundbreaking psychologist Stanley Milgram demonstrated this when, in an oft-cited experiment at Yale in the 1960s, he got decent, ordinary people
to apparently electrocute other subjects when given the nod by a man in a lab coat. There is a reason that we act this way. The personality traits that serve us well when we're at dinner with our family might get in the way when we're in a dispute with a passenger on the train or trying to finish a report at work. The plasticity of the self allows for social situations that would be impossible or intolerable if we always behaved exactly the same way. Advertisers have understood this phenomenon for a long time. In the jargon, it's called day-parting, and it's the reason that you don't hear many beer ads as you're driving to work in the morning. People have different needs and aspirations at 8 a.m. than they do at 8 p.m. By the same token, billboards in the nightlife district promote different products than billboards in the residential neighborhoods the same partiers go home to. On his own Facebook page, Zuckerberg lists transparency as one of his top likes. But there's a downside to perfect transparency. One of the most important uses of privacy is to manage and maintain the separations and distinctions among our different selves. With only one identity, you lose the nuances that make for a good, personalized fit. Personalization doesn't capture the balance between your work self and your play self, and it can also mess with the tension between your aspirational and your current self. How we behave is a balancing act between our future and present selves. In the future, we want to be fit, but in the present, we want the candy bar. In the future, we want to be a well-rounded, well-informed intellectual virtuoso, but right now, we want to watch Jersey Shore. Behavioral economists call this present bias, the gap between your preferences for your future self and your preferences in the current moment. The phenomenon explains why there are so many movies in your Netflix queue. When researchers at Harvard and the Analyst Institute looked at people's movie rental patterns, they were able to watch as people's future aspirations played against their current desires. Should movies like An Inconvenient Truth or Schindler's List were often added to the queue, but there they languished while watchers gobbled up want movies like Sleepless in Seattle. And when they had to choose three movies to watch instantly, they were less likely to choose should movies at all. Apparently, there are some movies we'd always rather watch tomorrow. At its best, media help mitigate present bias, mixing should stories with want stories and encouraging us to dig into the difficult but rewarding work of understanding complex problems. But the filter bubble tends to do the opposite. Because it's our present self that's doing all the clicking, the set of preferences it reflects is necessarily more want than should. The one identity problem isn't a fundamental flaw. It's more of a bug. Because Zuckerberg thinks you have one identity and you don't, Facebook will do a worse job of personalizing your information environment. As John Battelle told me, we're so far away from the nuances of what it means to be human as reflected in the nuances of the technology. Given enough data and enough programmers, the context problem is solvable, and according to personalization engineer Jonathan McPhee, Google is working on it. We've seen the pendulum swing from the anonymity of the early internet to the one identity view currently in vogue. The future may look like something in between. But the one identity problem illustrates one of the dangers of turning over your most personal details to companies who have a skewed view of what identity is. Maintaining separate identity zones is a ritual that helps us deal with the demands of different roles and communities. And something's lost when, at the end of the day, everything inside your filter bubble looks roughly the same. Your bacchanalian self comes knocking at work. Your work anxieties plague you on a night out. And when we're aware that everything we do enters a permanent, pervasive online record, another problem emerges. The knowledge that what we do affects what we see and how companies see us can create a chilling effect. Genetic privacy expert Mark Rothstein describes how lax regulations around genetic data can actually reduce the number of people willing to be tested for certain diseases. if you might be discriminated against or denied insurance for having a gene linked to Parkinson's disease, it's not unreasonable just to skip the test and the toxic knowledge that might result. In the same way, when our online actions are tallied and added to a record that companies use to make decisions, we might decide to be more cautious in our surfing. If we knew, or even suspected, for that matter, that purchasers of 101 Ways to Fix Your Credit Score tend to get offered lower premium credit cards, we'd avoid buying the book. If we thought that our every word and deed were public, writes law professor Charles Fried, fear of disapproval or more tangible retaliation might keep us from doing or saying things which we would do or say could we be sure of keeping them to ourselves. As Google expert Siva Vaidyanathan points out, F. Scott Fitzgerald's enigmatic Jay Gatsby could not exist today. The digital ghost of Jay Gats would follow him everywhere. In theory, the one identity, context-blind problem isn't impossible to fix. Personalizers will undoubtedly get better at sensing context. They might even be able to better balance long-term and short-term interests. But when they do, when they are able to accurately gauge the workings of your psyche, things get even weirder. Targeting your weak spots. The logic of the filter bubble today is still fairly rudimentary. People who bought the Iron Man DVD are likely to buy Iron Man 2. People who enjoy cookbooks will probably be interested in cookware. But for Dean Eccles, a doctoral student at Stanford and an advisor to Facebook, these simple recommendations are just the beginning. Eccles is interested in means, not ends. He cares less about what types of products you like than which kinds of arguments might cause you to choose one over the other. Eccles noticed that when buying products, say a digital camera, different people respond to different pitches. Some people feel comforted by the fact that an expert or product review site will vouch for the camera. Others prefer to go with the product that's most popular, or a money-saving deal, or a brand that they know and trust. Some people prefer what Eccles calls high cognition arguments, smart, subtle points that require some thinking to get. Others respond better to being hit over the head with a simple message. And while most of us have preferred styles of argument and validation, there are also types of arguments that really turn us off. Some people rush for a deal. Others think that the deal means the merchandise is subpar. Just by eliminating the persuasion styles that rub people the wrong way, Eccles found he could increase the effectiveness of marketing materials by 30% to 40%. While it's hard to jump categories in products, what clothing you prefer is only slightly related to what books you enjoy, persuasion profiling suggests that the kind of arguments you respond to are highly transferable from one domain to another. A person who responds to a get 20% off if you buy now deal for a trip to Bermuda is much more likely than someone who doesn't to respond to a similar deal for, say, a new laptop. If Eccles is right, and research so far appears to be validating his theory, your persuasion profile would have a pretty significant financial value. It's one thing to know how to pitch products to you in a specific domain. It's another to be able to improve the hit rate anywhere you go. And once a company like Amazon has figured out your profile by offering you different kinds of deals over time and seeing which ones you responded to, there's no reason it couldn't then sell that information to other companies. The field is so new that it's not clear if there's a correlation between persuasion styles and demographic traits, but obviously that could be a shortcut as well. There's plenty of good that could emerge from persuasion profiling, Eccles believes. He points to Direct Life, a wearable coaching device by Philips that figures out which arguments get people eating more healthily and exercising more regularly. But he told me he's troubled by some of the possibilities. Knowing what kinds of appeals specific people respond to gives you power to manipulate them on an individual basis. With new methods of sentiment analysis, it's now possible to guess what mood someone is in. people use substantially more positive words when they're feeling up. By analyzing enough of your text messages, Facebook posts, and emails, it's possible to tell good days from bad ones, sober messages from drunk ones, lots of typos for a start. At best, this can be used to provide content that's suited to your mood. On an awful day in the near future, Pandora might note a preload pretty hate machine for you when you arrive. But it can also be used to take advantage of your psychology. Consider the implications, for example, of knowing that particular customers compulsively buy things when stressed or when they're feeling bad about themselves or even when they're a bit tipsy. If persuasion profiling makes it possible for a coaching device to shout, "You can do it," to people who like positive reinforcement, in theory, it could also enable politicians to make appeals based on each voter's targeted fears and weak spots. Infomercials aren't shown in the middle of the night only because airtime then is cheap. In the wee hours, most people are especially suggestible. They'll spring for the slicer dicer that they'd never purchase in the light of day. But the 3 a.m. rule is a rough one. Presumably, there are times in all of our daily lives when we're especially inclined to purchase whatever's put in front of us. The same data that provides personalized content can be used to allow marketers to find and manipulate your personal weak spots. And this isn't a hypothetical possibility. Privacy researcher Pam Dixon discovered that a data company called PK List Management offers a list of customers titled "Free to Me, Impulse Buyers." Those listed are described as being highly susceptible to pitches framed as sweepstakes. If personalized persuasion works for products, it can also work for ideas. There are undoubtedly times and places and styles of argument that make us more susceptible to believe what we're told. Subliminal messaging is illegal because we recognize there are some ways of making an argument that are essentially cheating. Priming people with subconsciously flashed words to sell them things isn't a fair game. But it's not such a stretch to imagine political campaigns targeting voters at times when they can circumvent our more reasonable impulses. We intuitively understand the power in revealing our deep motivations and desires and how we work, which is why most of us only do that in day-to-day life with people whom we really trust. There's a symmetry to it. You know your friends about as well as they know you. Persuasion profiling, on the other hand, can be done invisibly. You need not have any knowledge that this data is being collected from you, and therefore it's asymmetrical. And unlike some forms of profiling that take place in plain sight, like Netflix, persuasion profiling is handicapped when it's revealed. It's just not the same to hear an automated coach say, "You're doing a great job." I'm telling you that because you respond well to encouragement. So you don't necessarily see the persuasion profile being made. You don't see it being used to influence your behavior, and the companies we're turning over this data to have no legal obligation to keep it to themselves. In the wrong hands, persuasion profiling gives companies the ability to circumvent your rational decision-making, tap into your psychology, and draw out your compulsions. Understand someone's identity, and you're better equipped to influence what he or she does. A deep and narrow path. Someday soon, Google Vice President Marissa Mayer says, the company hopes to make the search box obsolete. The next step of search is doing this automatically, Eric Schmidt said in 2010. When I walk down the street, I want my smartphone to be doing searches constantly. Did you know? Did you know? Should figure out what you would like to be searching for before you do. In the fast-approaching age of search without search, identity drives media. But the personalizers haven't fully grappled with a parallel fact. Media also shapes identity. Political scientist Shanto Iyengar calls one of primary factors accessibility bias, and in a paper titled "Experimental Demonstrations of the Not-So-Minimal Consequences of Television News" in 1982, he demonstrated how powerful the bias is. Over 6 days, Iyengar asked groups of New Haven residents to watch episodes of a TV news program, which he had doctored to include different segments for each group. Afterward, Iyengar asked subjects to rank how important issues like pollution, inflation, and defense were to them. The shifts from the surveys they'd filled out before the study were dramatic. Participants exposed to a steady stream of news about defense or about pollution came to believe that defense or pollution were more consequential problems, Iyengar wrote. Among the group that saw the clips on pollution, the issue moved from 5th out of 6 in priority to 2nd. Drew Weston, a neuropsychologist whose focus is on political persuasion, demonstrates the strength of this priming effect by asking a group of people to memorize a list of words that include moon and ocean. A few minutes later, he changes topics and asks the group which detergent they prefer. Though he hasn't mentioned the word, the group's show of hands indicates a strong preference for Tide. Priming isn't the only way media shape our identities. We're also more inclined to believe what we've heard before. In a 1977 study by Hasher and Goldstein, participants were asked to read 60 statements and mark whether they were true or false. All of the statements were plausible, but some of them, French horn players get cash bonuses to stay in the army, were true. Others, divorce is only found in technically advanced societies, weren't. 2 weeks later, they returned and rated a second batch of statements in which some of the items from the first list had been repeated. By the third time, 2 weeks after that, the subjects were far more likely to believe the repeated statements. With information, as with food, we are what we consume. All of these are basic psychological mechanisms, but combine them with personalized media and troubling things start to happen. Your identity shapes your media, and your media then shapes what you believe and what you care about. You click on a link which signals an interest in something, which means you're more likely to see articles about that topic in the future, which in turn prime the topic for you. You become trapped in a U-loop, and if your identity is misrepresented, strange patterns begin to emerge, like reverb from an amplifier. If you're a Facebook user, you've probably run into this problem. You look up your old college girlfriend, Sally, mildly curious to see what she is up to after all these years. Facebook interprets this as a sign that you're interested in Sally, and all of a sudden, her life is all over your newsfeed. You're still mildly curious, so you click through on the new photos she's posted of her kids and husband and pets, confirming Facebook's hunch. From Facebook's perspective, it looks as though you have a relationship with this person, even if you haven't communicated in years. For months afterward, Sally's life is far more prominent than your actual relationship would indicate. She's a local maximum. Though there are people whose posts you're far more interested in, it's her posts that you see. In part, this feedback effect is due to what early Facebook employee and venture capitalist Matt Kohler calls the local maximum problem. Kohler was an early employee at Facebook, and he's widely considered one of the smartest thinkers in Silicon Valley on the social web. The local maximum problem, he explains to me, shows up any time you're trying to optimize something. Say you're trying to write a simple set of instructions to help a blind person who's lost in the Sierra Nevadas find his way to the highest peak. Feel around you to see if you're surrounded by downward sloping land, you say. If you're not, move in a direction that's higher and repeat. Programmers face problems like this all the time. What link is the best result for the search term fish? Which picture can Facebook show you to increase the likelihood that you'll start a photo surfing binge? The directions sound pretty obvious. You just tweak and tune in one direction or another until you're in the sweet spot. But there's a problem with these hill-climbing instructions. They're as likely to end you up in the foothills, the local maximum, as they are to guide you to the apex of Mount Whitney. This isn't exactly harmful, but in the filter bubble, the same phenomenon can happen with any person or topic. I find it hard not to click on articles about gadgets, though I don't actually think they're that important. Personalized filters play to the most compulsive parts of you, creating compulsive media to get you to click things more. The technology mostly can't distinguish compulsion from general interest, and if you're generating page views that can be sold to advertisers, it might not care. The faster the system learns from you, the more likely it is that you can get trapped in a kind of identity cascade, in which a small initial action, clicking on a link about gardening or anarchy or Ozzy Osbourne, indicates that you're a person who likes those kinds of things. This, in turn, supplies you with more information on the topic, which you're more inclined to click on because the topic has now been primed for you. Especially once the second click has occurred, your brain is in on the act as well. Our brains act to reduce cognitive dissonance in a strange but compelling kind of unlogic. Why would I have done X if I weren't a person who does X? Therefore, I must be a person who does X. Each click you take in this loop is another action to self-justify. Boy, I guess I just really love Crazy Train. When you use a recursive process that feeds on itself, Kohler tells me, you're going to end up down a deep and narrow path. The reverb drowns out the tune. If identity loops aren't counteracted through randomness and serendipity, you could end up stuck in the foothills of your identity, far away from the high peaks in the distance. And that's when these loops are relatively benign. Sometimes they're not. We know what happens when teachers think students are dumb. They get dumber. In an experiment done before the advent of ethics boards, teachers were given test results that supposedly indicated the IQ and aptitude of students entering their classes. They weren't told, however, that the results had been randomly redistributed among students. After a year, the students who the teachers had been told were bright made big gains in IQ. The students who the teachers had been told were below average had no such improvement. So what happens when the internet thinks you're dumb? Personalization based on perceived IQ isn't such a far-fetched scenario. Google Docs even offers a helpful tool for automatically checking the grade level of written text. If your education level isn't already available through a tool like Axiom, it's easy enough for anyone with access to a few emails or Facebook posts to infer. Users whose writing indicates college-level literacy might see more articles from The New Yorker. Users with only basic writing skills might see more from The New York Post. In a broadcast world, everyone is expected to read or process information at about the same level. In the filter bubble, there's no need for that expectation. On one hand, this could be great. Vast groups of people who have given up on reading because the newspaper goes over their heads may finally connect with written content. But without pressure to improve, it's also possible to get stuck in a grade 3 world for a long time. Incidents and adventures. In some cases, letting algorithms make decisions about what we see and what opportunities we're offered gives us fairer results. A computer can be made blind to race and gender in ways that humans usually can't. But that's only if the relevant algorithms are designed with care and acuteness. Otherwise, they're likely to simply reflect the social mores of the culture they're processing, a regression to the social norm. In some cases, algorithmic sorting based on personal data can be even more discriminatory than people would be. For example, software that helps companies sift through resumes for talent might learn by looking at which of its recommended employees are actually hired. If 9 white candidates in a row are chosen, it might determine that the company isn't interested in hiring black people and exclude them from future searches. In many ways, writes NYU sociologist Dalton Conley, such network-based categorizations are more insidious than the hackneyed groupings based on race, class, gender, religion, or any other demographic characteristic. Among programmers, this kind of error has a name. It's called overfitting. The online movie rental website Netflix is powered by an algorithm called Cinematch. To start, it was pretty simple. If I had rented the first movie in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, let's say, Netflix could look up what other movies Lord of the Rings watchers had rented. If many of them had rented Star Wars, it'd be highly likely that I would want to rent it too. This technique is called KNN, K Nearest Neighbor. And using it, Cinematch got pretty good at figuring out what movies people wanted to watch based on what movies they'd rented and how many stars, out of 5, they'd given the movies they'd seen. By 2006, Cinematch could predict within 1 star how much a given user would like any movie from Netflix's vast 100,000 film emporium. Already, Cinematch was better at making recommendations than most humans. A human video clerk would never think to suggest Silence of the Lambs to a fan of The Wizard of Oz, but Cinematch knew people who liked one usually liked the other. But Reed Hastings, Netflix's CEO, wasn't satisfied. "Right now, we're driving the Model T version of what's possible," he told a reporter in 2006. On October 2, 2006, an announcement went up on the Netflix website. "We're interested, to the tune of $1 million. Netflix had posted an enormous swath of data, reviews, rental records, and other information from its user database, scrubbed of anything that would obviously identify a specific user. And now the company was willing to give $1 million to the person or team who beat Cinematch by more than 10%. Like the Longitude Prize, the Netflix challenge was open to everyone. "All you need is a PC and some great insight," Hastings declared in the New York Times. After 9 months, about 18,000 teams from more than 150 countries were competing, using ideas from machine learning, neural networks, collaborative filtering, and data mining. Usually, contestants in high-stakes contests operate in secret, but Netflix encouraged the competing groups to communicate with one another and built a message board where they could coordinate around common obstacles. "Read through the message board, and you get a visceral sense of the challenges that bedeviled the contestants during the 3-year quest for a better algorithm. Overfitting comes up again and again." There are 2 challenges in building pattern-finding algorithms. One is finding the patterns that are there in all the noise. The other problem is the opposite: not finding patterns in the data that aren't actually really there. The pattern that describes 1, 2, 3 could be "add 1 to the previous number," or "list positive prime numbers from smallest to biggest." You don't know for sure until you get more data, and if you leap to conclusions, you're overfitting. Where movies are concerned, the dangers of overfitting are relatively small. Many analog movie watchers have been led to believe that because they liked The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2, they'll like The Godfather Part 3. But the overfitting problem gets to one of the central, irreducible problems of the filter bubble. Overfitting and stereotyping are synonyms. The term stereotyping, which in this sense comes from Walter Lippmann, incidentally, is often used to refer to malicious xenophobic patterns that aren't true. "People of this skin color are less intelligent" is a classic example. But stereotypes and the negative consequences that flow from them aren't fair to specific people, even if they're generally pretty accurate. Marketers are already exploring the gray area between what can be predicted and what predictions are fair. According to Charlie Stryker, an old hand in the behavioral targeting industry who spoke at the Social Graph Summit, the U.S. Army has had terrific success using social graph data to recruit for the military. After all, if 6 of your Facebook buddies have enlisted, it's likely that you would consider doing so too. Drawing inferences based on what people like you or people linked to you do is pretty good business. And it's not just the Army. Banks are beginning to use social data to decide to whom to offer loans. If your friends don't pay on time, it's likely that you'll be a deadbeat too. A decision is going to be made on creditworthiness based on the creditworthiness of your friends, Stryker said. There are implications of this technology that can be very powerful, another social targeting entrepreneur told the Wall Street Journal. Who knows how far we'd take it? Part of what's troubling about this world is that companies aren't required to explain on what basis they're making these decisions, and as a result, you can get judged without knowing it and without being able to appeal. For example, LinkedIn, the social job hunting site, offers a career trajectory prediction site by comparing your resume to other people's who are in your field but further along. LinkedIn can forecast where you'll be in 5 years. Engineers at the company hope that soon it'll be able to pinpoint career choices that lead to better outcomes. Mid-level IT professionals like you who attended Wharton Business School made $25,000 a year more than those who didn't. As a service to customers, it's pretty useful. But imagine if LinkedIn provided that data to corporate clients to help them weed out people who are forecast to be losers. Because that could happen entirely without your knowledge, you'd never get the chance to argue, to prove the prediction wrong, to have the benefit of the doubt. If it seems unfair for banks to discriminate against you because your high school buddy is bad at paying his bills, or because you like something that a lot of loan defaulters also like, well, it is. And it points to a basic problem with induction, the logical method by which algorithms use data to make predictions. Philosophers have been wrestling with this problem since long before there were computers to induce with. While you can prove the truth of a mathematical proof by arguing it out from first principles, the philosopher David Hume pointed out in 1772 that reality doesn't work that way. As the investment cliché has it, past performance is not indicative of future results. This raises some big questions for science, which is, at its core, a method for using data to predict the future. Karl Popper, one of the preeminent philosophers of science, made it his life's mission to try to sort out the problem of induction, as it came to be known. While the optimistic thinkers of the late 1800s looked at the history of science and saw a journey toward truth, Popper preferred to focus on the wreckage along the side of the road, the abundance of failed theories and ideas that were perfectly consistent with the scientific method and yet horribly wrong. After all, the Ptolemaic universe, with the Earth in the center and the Sun and planets revolving around it, survived an awful lot of mathematical scrutiny and scientific observation. Popper posed his problem in a slightly different way. Just because you've only ever seen white swans doesn't mean that all swans are white. What you have to look for is the black swan, the counterexample that proves the theory wrong. Falsifiability, Popper argued, was the key to the search for truth. The purpose of science, for Popper, was to advance the biggest claims for which one could not find any countervailing examples, any black swans. Underlying Popper's view was a deep humility about scientifically induced knowledge, a sense that we're wrong as often as we're right, and we usually don't know when we are. It's this humility that many algorithmic prediction methods fail to build in. Sure, they encounter people or behaviors that don't fit the mold from time to time, but these aberrations don't fundamentally comprise their algorithms. After all, the advertisers whose money drives these systems don't need the models to be perfect. They're most interested in hitting demographics, not complex human beings. When you model the weather and predict there's a 70% chance of rain, it doesn't affect the rain clouds. It either rains or it doesn't. But when you predict that because my friends are untrustworthy, there's a 70% chance that I'll default on my loan, there are consequences if you get me wrong. You're discriminating. The best way to avoid overfitting, as Popper suggests, is to try to prove the model wrong and to build algorithms that give the benefit of the doubt. If Netflix shows me a romantic comedy and I like it, it'll show me another one and begin to think of me as a romantic comedy lover. But if it wants to get a good picture of who I really am, it should be constantly testing the hypothesis by showing me Blade Runner in an attempt to prove it wrong. Otherwise, I end up caught in a local maximum populated by Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts. The statistical models that make up the filter bubble write off the outliers. But in human life, it's the outliers who make things interesting and give us inspiration, and it's the outliers who are the first signs of change. One of the best critiques of algorithmic prediction comes, remarkably, from the late 19th century Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky, whose Notes from the Underground was a passionate critique of the utopian scientific rationalism of the day. Dostoevsky looked at the regimented, ordered human life that science promised and predicted a banal future. All human actions, the novel's unnamed narrator grumbles, will then, of course, be tabulated according to these laws mathematically, like tables of logarithms up to 108,000 and entered in an index, in which everything will be so clearly calculated and explained that there will be no more incidents or adventures in the world. The world often follows predictable rules and falls into predictable patterns. Tides rise and fall. Eclipses approach and pass. Even the weather is more and more predictable. But when this way of thinking is applied to human behavior, it can be dangerous, for the simple reason that our best moments are often the most unpredictable ones. An entirely predictable life isn't worth living. But algorithmic induction can lead to a kind of information determinism, in which our past click streams entirely decide our future. If we don't erase our web histories, in other words, we may be doomed to repeat them. 5. The public is irrelevant. The presence of others who see what we see and hear what we hear assures us of the reality of the world and ourselves. Hannah Arendt. It is an axiom of political science in the United States that the only way to neutralize the influence of the newspapers is to multiply their number. Alexis de Tocqueville. On the night of May 7, 1999, a B-2 stealth bomber left Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. The aircraft flew on an easterly course until it reached the city of Belgrade in Serbia, where a civil war was underway. Around midnight, local time, the bomber delivered its cargo, 4 GPS-guided bombs, into which had been programmed an address that CIA documents identified as a possible arms warehouse. In fact, the address was the Yugoslavian Chinese Embassy. The building was demolished, and 3 Chinese diplomats were killed. The United States immediately apologized, calling the event an accident. On Chinese state TV, however, an official statement called the bombing a barbaric attack and a gross violation of Chinese sovereignty. Though President Bill Clinton tried to reach Chinese President Jiang Zemin, Zemin repeatedly rejected his calls. Clinton's videotaped apology to the Chinese people was barred from Chinese media for 4 days. As anti-U.S. riots began to break out in the streets, China's largest newspaper, The People's Daily, created an online chat forum called the Anti-Bombing Forum. Already in 1999, chat forums were huge in China, much larger than they've ever been in the United States. As New York Times journalist Tom Downey explained a few years later, news sites and individual blogs aren't nearly as influential in China, and social networking hasn't really taken off. What remain most vital are the largely anonymous online forums that are much more participatory, dynamic, populist, and perhaps even democratic than anything on the English-language internet. Tech writer Clive Thompson quotes Shanti Kalatil, a researcher at the Carnegie Endowment, who says that the anti-bombing forum helped to legitimize the Chinese government's position that the bombing was deliberate among an elite, wired section of the population. The forum was a form of crowd-sourced propaganda. Rather than just telling Chinese citizens what to think, it lifted the voices of thousands of patriots aligned with the state. Most of the Western reporting on Chinese information management focuses on censorship. Google's choice to remove, temporarily, search results for Tiananmen Square, or Microsoft's decision to ban the word democracy from Chinese blog posts, or the great firewall that sits between China and the outside world and sifts through every packet of information that enters or exits the country. Censorship in China is real. There are plenty of words that have been more or less stricken from the public discourse. When Thompson asks whether the popular Alibaba engine would show results for dissident movements, CEO Jack Ma shook his head. "No, we are a business," he said. "Shareholders want to make money. Shareholders want us to make the customer happy. Meanwhile, we do not have any responsibilities saying we should do this or that political thing." In practice, the firewall is not so hard to circumvent. Corporate virtual private networks, internet connections encrypted to prevent espionage, operate with impunity. Proxies and firewall workarounds like Tor connect in-country Chinese dissidents with even the most hardcore anti-government websites. But to focus exclusively on the firewall's inability to perfectly block information is to miss the point. China's objective isn't so much to blot out unsavory information as to alter the physics around it, to create friction for problematic information, and to route public attention to pro-government forums. While it can't block all of the people from all of the news all of the time, it doesn't need to. What the government cares about, Atlantic journalist James Fallows writes, is making the quest for information just enough of a nuisance that people generally won't bother. The strategy, says Xiao Chang of the University of California at Berkeley, is about social control, human surveillance, peer pressure, and self-censorship. Because there's no official list of blocked keywords or forbidden topics published by the government, businesses and individuals censor themselves to avoid a visit from the police. Which sites are available changes daily. And while some bloggers suggest that the system's unreliability is a result of faulty technology, the internet will override attempts to control it. For the government, this is a feature, not a bug. James Mulvenon, the head of the Center for Intelligence Research and Analysis, puts it this way. There's a randomness to their enforcement, and that creates a sense that they're looking at everything. Lest that sensation be too subtle, the Public Security Bureau in Shenzhen, China, developed a more direct approach, Jingjing and Chacha, the cartoon internet police. As the director of the initiative told the China Digital Times, he wanted to let all internet users know that the internet is not a place beyond law and that the internet police will maintain order in all online behavior. Icons of the male-female pair, complete with jaunty flying epaulets and smart black shoes, were placed on all major websites in Shenzhen. They even had instant message addresses so that 6 police officers could field questions from the online crowds. "People are actually quite free to talk about democracy," Google's China point man Kai-Fu Li told Thompson in 2006. "I don't think they care that much. Hey, U.S. democracy? That's a good form of government. Chinese government, good and stable, that's a good form of government. Whatever, as long as I get to go to my favorite website, see my friends, live happily." It may not be a coincidence that the Great Firewall stopped blocking pornography recently. Maybe they are thinking that if internet users have some porn to look at, then they won't pay so much attention to political matters, Michael Onti, a Beijing-based analyst, told the AP. "We usually think about censorship as a process by which governments alter facts and content. When the internet came along, many hoped it would eliminate censorship altogether. The flow of information would simply be too swift and strong for governments to control. There's no question China has been trying to crack down on the internet," Bill Clinton told the audience at a March 2000 speech at Johns Hopkins University. "Good luck! That's sort of like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. But in the age of the Internet, it's still possible for governments to manipulate the truth. The process has just taken a different shape. Rather than simply banning certain words or opinions outright, it'll increasingly revolve around second-order censorship, the manipulation of curation, context, and the flow of information and attention. And because the filter bubble is primarily controlled by a few centralized companies, it's not as difficult to adjust this flow on an individual-by-individual basis as you might think. Rather than decentralizing power, as its early proponents predicted, in some ways, the Internet is concentrating it.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Lords of the Cloud. To get a sense of how personalization might be used for political ends, I talked to a man named John Rendon. Rendon affably describes himself as an information warrior and perception manager. From the Rendon Group's headquarters in Washington, D.C.'s DuPont Circle, he provides those services to dozens of U.S. agencies and foreign governments. When American troops rolled into Kuwait City during the first Iraq War, television cameras captured hundreds of Kuwaitis joyfully waving American flags. "Did you ever stop to wonder," he asked an audience later, "how the people of Kuwait City, after being held hostage for 7 long and painful months, were able to get handheld American flags? And for that matter, the flags of other coalition countries?" Well, you now know the answer. That was one of my jobs. Much of Rendon's work is confidential. He enjoys a level of beyond top-secret clearance that even high-level intelligence analysts sometimes fail to get. His role in George W. Bush-era pro-U.S. propaganda in Iraq is unclear. While some sources claim he was a central figure in the effort, Rendon denies any involvement. But his dream is quite clear. Rendon wants to see a world where television can drive the policy process, where border patrols are replaced by beaming patrols, and where you can win without fighting. Given all that, I was a bit surprised when the first weapon he referred me to was a very quotidian one, a thesaurus. The key to changing public opinion, Rendon said, is finding different ways to say the same thing. He described a matrix with extreme language or opinion on one side and mild opinion on the other. By using sentiment analysis to figure out how people in a country felt about an event, say a new arms deal with the United States, and identify the right synonyms to move them toward approval, you could gradually nudge a debate. It's a lot easier to be close to what reality is and push it in the right direction, he said, than to make up a new reality entirely. Rendon had seen me talk about personalization at an event we both attended. Filter bubbles, he told me, provided new ways of managing perceptions. It begins with getting inside the algorithm. If you could find a way to load your content up so that only your content gets pulled by the stalking algorithm, then you'd have a better chance of shaping belief sets, he said. In fact, he suggested, if we looked in the right places, we might be able to see traces of this kind of thing happening now, sentiment being algorithmically shifted over time. But if the filter bubble might make shifting perspectives easier in a future Iraq or Panama, Rendon was clearly concerned about the impact of self-sorting and personalized filtering for democracy at home. If I'm taking a photo of a tree, he said, I need to know what season we're in. Every season it looks different. It could be dying or just losing its leaves in autumn. To make good decisions, context is crucial. That's why the military is so focused on what they call 360-degree situational awareness. In the filter bubble, you don't get 360 degrees, and you might not get more than one. I return to the question about using algorithms to shift sentiment. How does someone game the system when it's all about self-generated, self-reinforcing information flows? I have to think about it more, Rendon said. but I think I know how I'd do it.
How? I asked. He paused, then chuckled.
Nice try. He'd already said too much.
The campaign of propaganda that Walter Lippmann railed against in World War I was a massive undertaking. To goose-step the truth, hundreds of newspapers nationwide had to be brought on board. Now that every blogger is a publisher, the task seems nearly impossible. In 2010, Google chief Eric Schmidt echoed this sentiment, arguing in the journal Foreign Affairs that the Internet eclipses intermediaries and governments and empowers individuals to consume, distribute, and create their own content without government control. It's a convenient view for Google. If intermediaries are losing power, then the company's merely a minor player in a much larger drama. But in practice, a great majority of online content reaches people through a small number of websites, Google foremost among them. These big companies represent new loci of power, and while their multinational character makes them resistant to some forms of regulation, they can also offer one-stop shopping for governments seeking to influence information flows. As long as a database exists, it's potentially accessible by the state. That's why gun rights activists talk a lot about Alfred Flatow. Flatow was an Olympic gymnast and German Jew who in 1932 registered his gun in accordance with the laws of the waning Weimar Republic. In 1938, German police came to his door. They'd searched through the record, and in preparation for the Holocaust, they were rounding up Jews with handguns. Flatow was killed in a concentration camp in 1942. For National Rifle Association members, the story is a powerful cautionary tale about the dangers of a national gun registry. As a result of Flatow's story and thousands like it, the NRA has successfully blocked a national gun registry for decades. If a fascistic anti-Semitic regime came into power in the United States, it'd be hard put to identify gun-holding Jews using its own databases. But the NRA's focus may have been too narrow. Fascists aren't known for carefully following the letter of the law regarding extra-governmental databases, and using the data that credit card companies use, or for that matter, building models based on the thousands of data points Axiom tracks, it'd be a simple matter to predict with significant accuracy who has a gun and who does not. Even if you aren't a gun advocate, the story is worth paying attention to. The dynamics of personalization shift power into the hands of a few major corporate actors, and this consolidation of huge masses of data offers governments, even democratic ones, more potential power than ever. Rather than housing their websites and databases internally, many businesses and startups now run on virtual computers in vast server farms managed by other companies. The enormous pool of computing power and storage these networked machines create is known as the cloud, and it allows clients much greater flexibility. If your business runs in the cloud, you don't need to buy more hardware when your processing demands expand. You just rent a greater portion of the cloud. Amazon Web Services, one of the major players in the space, hosts thousands of websites and web servers and undoubtedly stores the personal data of millions. On one hand, the cloud gives every kid in his or her basement access to nearly unlimited computing power to quickly scale up a new online service. On the other, as Clive Thompson pointed out to me, the cloud is actually just a handful of companies. When Amazon booted the activist website WikiLeaks off its servers under political pressure in 2010, the site immediately collapsed. There was nowhere to go. Personal data stored in the cloud is also actually much easier for the government to search than information on a home computer. The FBI needs a warrant from a judge to search your laptop. But if you use Yahoo or Gmail or Hotmail for your email, you lose your constitutional protections immediately, according to a lawyer for the Electronic Freedom Foundation. The FBI can just ask the company for the information, no judicial paperwork needed, no permission required,
as long as it can argue later that it's part of an emergency. The cops will love this, says privacy advocate Robert Gelman about cloud computing. They can go to a single place and get everybody's documents. Because of the economies of scale and data, the cloud giants are increasingly powerful. And because they're so susceptible to regulation, these companies have a vested interest in keeping government entities happy. When the Justice Department requested billions of search records from AOL, Yahoo, and MSN in 2006, the three companies quickly complied. Google, to its credit, opted to fight the request. Stephen Arnold, an IT expert who worked at consulting firm Booz Allen Hamilton, says that Google at one point housed three officers of an unnamed intelligence agency at its headquarters in Mountain View. And Google and the CIA have invested together in a firm called Recorded Future, which focuses on using data connections to predict future real-world events. Even if the consolidation of this data power doesn't result in more governmental control, it's worrisome on its own terms. One of the defining traits of the new personal information environment is that it's asymmetrical. As Jonathan Zittrain argues in The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, nowadays an individual must increasingly give information about himself to large and relatively faceless institutions for handling and use by strangers, unknown, unseen, and all too frequently unresponsive. In a small town or an apartment building with paper-thin walls, what I know about you is roughly the same as what you know about me. That's a basis for a social contract in which we'll deliberately ignore some of what we know. The new privacy-less world does away with that contract. I can know a lot about you without your knowing I know. There's an implicit bargain in our behavior, search expert John Battelle told me, that we haven't done the math on. If Sir Francis Bacon is right that knowledge is power, privacy proponent Victor Mayer Schoenberger writes that what we're witnessing now is nothing less than a redistribution of information power from the powerless to the powerful. It'd be one thing if we all knew everything about each other. It's another when centralized entities know a lot more about us than we know about each other, and sometimes more than we know about ourselves. If knowledge is power, then asymmetries in knowledge are asymmetries in power. Google's famous "Don't be evil" motto is presumably intended to allay some of these concerns. I once explained to a Google search engineer that while I didn't think the company was currently evil, it seemed to have at its fingertips everything it needed to do evil if it wished. He smiled broadly. Right, he said. We're not evil. We try really hard not to be evil. But if we wanted to, man, could we ever? Friendly World Syndrome. Most governments and corporations have used the new power that personal data and personalization offer fairly cautiously so far. China, Iran, and other oppressive regimes, being the obvious rise of filtering, has a number of unintended yet serious consequences for democracies. In the filter bubble, the public sphere, the realm in which common problems are identified and addressed, is just less relevant. For one thing, there's the problem of the friendly world. Communications researcher George Gerbner was one of the first theorists to look into how media affect our political beliefs, and in the mid-1970s, he spent a lot of time thinking about shows like Starsky and Hutch. It was a pretty silly program, filled with the shared cliches of 70s cop TV, the bushy mustaches, the twanging soundtracks, the simplistic good versus evil plots. And it was hardly the only one. For every Charlie's Angels or Hawaii Five-O that earned a place in cultural memory, there are dozens of shows like The Rockford Files, Get Christie Love, and Adam 12 that are unlikely to be resuscitated for ironic 21st century remakes. But Gerbner, a World War II veteran turned communications theorist who became dean of the Annenberg School of Communication, took these shows seriously. Starting in 1969, he began a systematic study of the way TV programming affects how we think about the world. As it turned out, the Starsky and Hutch effect was significant. When you asked TV watchers to estimate the percentage of the adult workforce that was made up of cops, they vastly overguessed relative to non-TV watchers with the same education and demographic background. Even more troubling, kids who saw a lot of TV violence were much more likely to be worried about real-world violence. Gerbner called this the mean world syndrome. If you grow up in a home where there's more than, say, 3 hours of television per day, for all practical purposes, you live in a meaner world and act accordingly than your next-door neighbor who lives in the same place but watches less television. You know, who tells the stories of a culture really governs human behavior, Gerbner later said. Gerbner died in 2005. But he lived long enough to see the internet begin to break that stranglehold. It must have been a relief. Although our online cultural storytellers are still quite consolidated, the internet at least offers more choice. If you want to get your local news from a blogger rather than a local TV station that trumpets crime rates to get ratings, you can. But if the mean world syndrome poses less of a risk these days, there's a new problem on the horizon. We may now face what persuasion profiling theorist Dean Eccles calls a friendly world syndrome, in which some of the biggest and most important problems fail to reach our view at all. While the mean world on television arises from a cynical, if it bleeds, it leads approach to programming, the friendly world generated by algorithmic filtering may not be as intentional. According to Facebook engineer Andrew Bosworth, the team that developed the like button originally considered a number of options, from stars to a thumbs-up sign, but in Iran and Thailand, it's an obscene gesture. For a month in the summer of 2007, the button was known as the Awesome Button. Eventually, however, the Facebook team gravitated toward like, which is more universal. That Facebook chose like instead of, say, important, is a small design decision with far-reaching consequences. The stories that get the most attention on Facebook are the stories that get the most likes, and the stories that get the most likes are, well, more likable. Facebook is hardly the only filtering service that will tend toward an antiseptically friendly world. As Eccles pointed out to me, even Twitter, which has a reputation for putting filtering in the hands of its users, has this tendency. Twitter users see most of the tweets of the folks they follow, but if my friend is having an exchange with someone I don't follow, it doesn't show up. The intent is entirely innocuous. Twitter is trying not to inundate me with conversations I'm not interested in. But the result is that conversations between my friends, who will tend to be like me, are overrepresented, while conversations that could introduce me to new ideas are obscured. Of course, friendly doesn't describe all of the stories that pierce the filter bubble and shape our sense of the political world. As a progressive political news junkie, I get plenty of news about Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck. The valence of this news, however, is very predictable. People are posting it to signal their dismay with Beck's and Palin's rhetoric and to build a sense of solidarity with their friends, who presumably feel the same way. It's rare that my assumptions about the world are shaken by what I see in my newsfeed. Emotional stories are the ones that generally thrive in the filter bubble. The Wharton School study on the New York Times' most forwarded list, discussed in Chapter 2, found that stories that aroused strong feelings, awe, anxiety, anger, happiness, were much more likely to be shared. If television gives us a mean world, filter bubbles give us an emotional world. One of the troubling side effects of the friendly world syndrome is that some important public problems will disappear. Few people seek out information about homelessness, or share it, for that matter. In general, dry, complex, slow-moving problems, a lot of the truly significant issues, won't make the cut. And while we used to rely on human editors to spotlight these crucial problems, their influence is now waning. Even advertising isn't necessarily a foolproof way of alerting people to public problems, as the environmental group Oceana found out. In 2004, Oceana was running a campaign urging Royal Caribbean to stop dumping its raw sewage into the sea. As part of the campaign, it took out a Google ad that said, "Help us protect the world's oceans. Join the fight." After 2 days, Google pulled the ads, citing language advocating against the cruise line industry that was in violation of their general guidelines about taste. Apparently, advertisers that implicated corporations in public issues weren't welcome. The filter bubble will often block out the things in our society that are important but complex or unpleasant. It renders them invisible. And it's not just the issues that disappear. Increasingly, it's the whole political process. The Invisible Campaign. When George W. Bush came out of the 2000 election with far fewer votes than Karl Rove expected, Rove set in motion a series of experiments in micro-targeted media in Georgia, looking at a wide range of consumer data, do you prefer beer or wine, to try to predict voting behavior and identify who was persuadable and who could be easily motivated to get to the polls. Though the findings are still secret, legend has it that the methods Rove discovered were at the heart of the GOP's successful get-out-the-vote strategy in 2002 and 2004. On the left, Catalyst, a firm staffed by former Amazon engineers, has built a database of hundreds of millions of voter profiles. For a fee, organizing and activist groups, including Move On, query it to help determine which doors to knock on and to whom to run ads. And that's just the start. In a memo for fellow progressives, Mark Stites, one of the primary Democratic data gurus, recently wrote that targeting too often returns to a bombing metaphor, dropping message from planes. Yet the best data tools help build relationships based on observed contacts with people. Someone at the door finds out someone is interested in education. We get back to that person and others like him or her with more information. Amazon's recommendation engine is the direction we need to head. The trend is clear. We're moving from swing states to swing people. Consider this scenario. It's 2016, and the race is on for the presidency of the United States. Or is it? It depends on who you are, really. If the data says you vote frequently and that you may have been a swing voter in the past, the race is a maelstrom. You're besieged with ads, calls, and invitations from friends. If you vote intermittently, you get a lot of encouragement to get out to the polls. But let's say you're more like an average American. You usually vote for candidates from one party. To the data crunchers from the opposing party, you don't look particularly persuadable. And because you vote in presidential elections pretty regularly, you're also not a target for get-out-the-vote calls from your own. Though you make it to the polls as a matter of civic duty, you're not that actively interested in politics. You're more interested in, say, soccer and robots and curing cancer and what's going on in the town where you live. Your personalized news feeds reflect those interests, not the news from the latest campaign stop. In a filtered world with candidates micro-targeting the few persuadables, would you know that the campaign was happening at all? Even if you visit a site that aims to cover the race for a general audience, it'll be difficult to tell what's going on. What is the campaign about? There is no general top-line message because the candidates aren't appealing to a general public. Instead, there are a series of message fragments designed to penetrate personalized filters. Google is preparing for this future. Even in 2010, it staffed a round-the-clock war room for political advertising, aiming to be able to quickly sign off on and activate new ads, even in the wee hours of October nights. Yahoo is conducting a series of experiments to determine how to match the publicly available list of who voted in each district with the click signals and web history data it picks up on its site. And data aggregation firms like Rapleaf in San Francisco are trying to correlate Facebook social graph information with voting behavior so that they can show you the political ad that best works for you based on the responses of your friends. The impulse to talk to voters about the things they're actually interested in isn't a bad one. It'd be great if mere mention of the word politics didn't cause so many eyes to glaze over. And certainly the internet has unleashed the coordinated energy of a whole new generation of activists. It's easier than ever to find people who share your political passions. But while it's easier than ever to bring a group of people together, as personalization advances, it'll become harder for any given group to reach a broad audience. In some ways, personalization poses a threat to public life itself. Because the state of the art in political advertising is half a decade behind the state of the art in commercial advertising, most of this change is still to come. But for starters, filter bubble politics could effectively make even more of us into single-issue voters. Like personalized media, personalized advertising is a two-way street. I may see an ad about, say, preserving the environment because I drive a Prius, but seeing the ad also makes me care more about preserving the environment. And if a congressional campaign can determine that this is the issue on which it's most likely to persuade me, why bother filling me in on all of the other issues? In theory, market dynamics will continue to encourage campaigns to reach out to non-voters, but an additional complication is that more and more companies are also allowing users to remove advertisements they don't like. For Facebook and Google, after all, seeing ads for ideas or services you don't like is a failure. Because people tend to dislike ads containing messages they disagree with, this creates even less space for persuasion. If a certain number of anti-Mitt Republicans saw an ad for Mitt Romney and clicked offensive, etc., writes Vincent Harris, a Republican political consultant, they could block all of Mitt Romney's ads from being shown and kill the entire online advertising campaign, regardless of how much money the Romney campaign wanted to spend on Facebook. Forcing candidates to come up with more palatable ways to make their points might result in more thoughtful ads, but it also might drive up the cost of these ads, making it too costly for campaigns to ever engage the other side. The most serious political problem posed by filter bubbles is that they make it increasingly difficult to have a public argument. As the number of different segments and messages increases, it becomes harder and harder for the campaigns to track who's saying what to whom. TV is a piece of cake to monitor in comparison. You can just record the opposition's ads in each cable district. But how does a campaign know what its opponent is saying if ads are only targeted to white Jewish men between 28 and 34 who have expressed a fondness for U2 on Facebook and who donated to Barack Obama's campaign? When a conservative political group called Americans for Job Security ran ads in 2010, falsely accusing Representative Pete Hoekstra of refusing to sign a No New Taxes pledge, he was able to show TV stations the signed pledge and have the ads pulled off the air. It's not great to have TV station owners be the sole arbitrators of truth. I've spent a fair amount of time arguing with them myself. But it is better to have some bar for truthfulness than none at all. It's unclear that companies like Google have the resources or the interest to play truthfulness referee on the hundreds of thousands of different ads that will run in election cycles to come. As personal political targeting increases, not only will it be more difficult for campaigns to respond to and fact-check each other, it'll be more challenging for journalists as well. We may see an environment where the most important ads aren't easily accessible to journalists and bloggers. It's easy enough for campaigns to exclude them from their targeting, and difficult for reporters to fabricate the profile of a genuine swing voter. One simple solution to this problem would simply be to require campaigns to immediately disclose all of their online advertising materials and to whom each ad is targeted. Right now, the former is spotty and the latter is undisclosed. It's not that political TV ads are so great. For the most part, they're shrill, unpleasant, and unlikable. If we could, most of us would tune them out. But in the broadcast era, they did at least three useful things. They reminded people that there was an election in the first place. They established for everyone what the candidates valued, what their campaigns were about, what their arguments were, the parameters of the debate. And they provided a basis for a common conversation about the political decision we faced, something you could talk about in the line at the supermarket. For all of their faults, political campaigns are one of the primary places where we debate our ideas about our nation. Does America condone torture? Are we a nation of social Darwinists or of social welfare? Who are our heroes and who are our villains? In the broadcast era, campaigns have helped to delineate the answers to those questions, but they may not do so for very much longer. Fragmentation. The aim of modern political marketing, consumer trends expert J. Walker Smith tells Bill Bishop in The Big Sort, is to drive customer loyalty and, in marketing terms, drive the average transaction size or improve the likelihood that a registered Republican will get out and vote Republican. That's a business philosophy applied to politics that I think is really dangerous because it's not about trying to form a consensus to get people to think about the greater good. In part, this approach to politics is on the rise for the same reason the filter bubble is. Personalized outreach gives better bang for the political buck. But it's also a natural outcome of a well-documented shift in how people in industrialized countries think about what's important. When people don't have to worry about having their basic needs met, they care a lot more about having products and leaders that represent who they are. Professor Ron Engelhardt calls this trend post-materialism, and it's a result of the basic premise, he writes, that you place the greatest subjective value on the things in short supply. In surveys spanning 40 years and 80 countries, people who were raised in affluence, who never had to worry about their physical survival, behaved in ways strikingly different from those of their hungry parents. We can even specify, Engelhardt writes, in Modernization and Postmodernization, with far better than random success, what issues are likely to be most salient in the politics of the respective types of societies. While there are still significant differences from country to country, post-materialists share some important traits. They're less reverent about authority and traditional institutions. The appeal of authoritarian strongmen appears to be connected to a basic fear for survival. They're more tolerant of difference. One especially striking chart shows a strong correlation between level of life satisfaction and comfort with living next door to someone who's gay. And while earlier generations emphasize financial achievement and order, post-materialists value self-expression and being yourself. Somewhat confusingly, post-materialism doesn't mean anti-consumption. Actually, the phenomenon is at the bedrock of our current consumer culture. Whereas we once bought things because we needed them to survive, now we mostly buy things as a means of self-expression. And the same dynamics hold for political leadership. Increasingly, voters evaluate candidates on whether they represent an aspirational version of themselves. The result is what marketers call brand fragmentation. When brands were primarily about validating the quality of a product, Dove soap is pure and made of the best ingredients, advertisements focused more on the basic value proposition. But when brands became vehicles for expressing identity, they needed to speak more intimately to different groups of people with divergent identities they wanted to express. And as a result, they started to splinter. Which is why what's happened to Pabst Blue Ribbon beer is a good way of understanding the challenges faced by Barack Obama. In the early 2000s, Pabst was struggling financially. It had maxed out among the white rural population that formed the core of its customer base, and it was selling less than 1 million barrels of beer a year, down from 20 million in 1970. If Pabst wanted to sell more beer, it had to look elsewhere, and Neil Stewart, a mid-level marketing manager, did. Stewart went to Postland, Oregon, where Pabst numbers were surprisingly strong and an ironic nostalgia for white working-class culture, remember trucker hats, was widespread. If Pabst couldn't get people to drink its watery brew sincerely, Stewart figured, maybe they could get people to drink it ironically. Pabst began to sponsor hipster events, gallery openings, bike messenger races, snowboarding competitions, and the like. Within a year, sales were way up, which is why, if you walk into a bar in certain Brooklyn neighborhoods, Pabst is more likely to be available than other low-end American beers. That's not the only excursion in renovation that Pabst did. In China, where it is branded a world-famous spirit, Pabst has made itself into a luxury beverage for the cosmopolitan elite. Advertisements compare it to Scotch whiskey, French brandy, Bordeaux wine, and present it in a fluted champagne glass atop a wooden cask. A bottle runs about $44 in U.S. currency. What's interesting about the Pabst story is that it's not rebranding of the typical sort, in which a product aimed at one group is repositioned to appeal to another. Plenty of white working-class men still drink Pabst sincerely, an affirmation of down-home culture. Urban hipsters drink it with a wink, and wealthy Chinese yuppies drink it as a champagne substitute and a signifier of conspicuous consumption. The same beverage means very different things to different people. Driven by the centrifugal pull of different market segments, each of which wants products that represent its identity, political leadership is fragmenting in much the same way as PBR. Much has been made of Barack Obama's chameleonic political style. "I serve as a blank screen," he wrote in The Audacity of Hope in 2006, on which people of vastly different political stripes project their own views. Part of that is a result of Obama's intrinsic political versatility, but it's also a plus in an age of fragmentation. To be sure, the internet can also facilitate consolidation, as Obama learned when his comment about people clinging to guns and religion to donors in San Francisco was reported by the Huffington Post and became a top campaign talking point against him. At the same time, Williamsburg hipsters who read the right blogs can learn about Pabst's Chinese marketing scheme. But while this makes fragmentation a more perilous process and cuts against authenticity, it doesn't fundamentally change the calculus. It just makes it more of an imperative to target well. The downside of this fragmentation, as Obama has learned, is that it is harder to lead. Acting different with different political constituencies isn't new. In fact, it's probably about as old as politics itself. But the overlap, content that remains constant between all of those constituencies, is shrinking dramatically. You can stand for lots of different kinds of people or stand for something, but doing both is harder every day. Personalization is both a cause and an effect of the brand fragmentation process. The filter bubble wouldn't be so appealing if it didn't play to our post-material desire to maximize self-expression. But once we're in it, the process of matching who we are to content streams can lead to the erosion of common experience, and it can stretch political leadership to the breaking point. Discourse and democracy. The good news about post-material politics is that as countries become wealthier, they'll likely become more tolerant, and their citizens will be more self-expressive. But there's a dark side to it, too. Ted Nordhaus, a student of Engelhardt's who focuses on post-materialism and the environmental movement, told me that the shadow that comes with post-materialism is profound self-involvement. We lose all perspective on the collective endeavors that have made the extraordinary lives we live possible. In a post-material world where your highest task is to express yourself, the public infrastructure that supports this kind of expression falls out of the picture. But while we can lose sight of our shared problems, they don't lose sight of us. A few times a year when I was growing up, the 900-person hamlet of Lincolnville, Maine, held a town meeting. This was my first impression of democracy. A few hundred residents crammed into the grade school auditorium or basement to discuss school additions, speed limits, zoning regulations, and hunting ordinances. In the aisle between the rows of gray metal folding chairs was a microphone on a stand where people would line up to say their piece. It was hardly a perfect system. Some speakers droned on, others were shouted down. But it gave all of us a sense of the kinds of people that made up our community that we wouldn't have gotten anywhere else. If the discussion was about encouraging more businesses along the coast, you'd hear from the wealthy summer vacationers who enjoyed their peace and quiet, the back-to-the-land hippies with anti-development sentiments, and the families who'd lived in rural poverty for generations and saw the influx as a way up and out. The conversation went back and forth, sometimes closing toward consensus, sometimes fragmenting into debate, but usually resulting in a decision about what to do next. I always liked how those town meetings worked, but it wasn't until I read On Dialogue that I fully understood what they accomplished. Born to Hungarian and Lithuanian Jewish furniture store owners in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, David Bohm came from humble roots. But when he arrived at the University of California, Berkeley, he quickly fell in with a small group of theoretical physicists under the direction of Robert Oppenheimer, who were racing to build the atomic bomb. By the time he died at 72 in October 1992, many of his colleagues would remember Bohm as one of the great physicists of the 20th century. But if quantum math was his vocation, there was another matter that took up much of Bohm's time. Bohm was preoccupied with the problems created by advanced civilization, especially the possibility of nuclear war. Technology keeps on advancing with greater and greater power, either for good or for destruction, he wrote. What is the source of all this trouble? I'm saying that the source is basically in thought. For Bohm, the solution became clear. It was dialogue. In 1992, one of his definitive texts on the subject was published. To communicate, Bohm wrote, literally means to make something common. And while sometimes this process of making common involves simply sharing a piece of data with a group, more often it involves the groups coming together to create a new common meaning. In dialogue, he writes, people are participants in a pool of common meaning. Bohm wasn't the first theorist to see the democratic potential of dialogue. Jürgen Habermas, the dean of media theory for much of the 20th century, had a similar view. For both, dialogue was special because it provided a way for a group of people to democratically create their culture and to calibrate their ideas in the world. In a way, you couldn't have a functioning democracy without it. Bohm saw an additional reason why dialogue was useful. It provided people with a way of getting a sense of the whole shape of a complex system, even the parts that they didn't directly participate in. Our tendency, Bohm says, is to rip apart and fragment ideas and conversations into bits that have no relation to the whole. He used the example of a watch that has been shattered. Unlike the parts that made up the watch previously, the pieces have no relation to the watch as a whole. They're just little bits of glass and metal. It's this quality that made the Lincolnville town meetings something special. Even if the group couldn't always agree on where to go, the process helped to develop a shared map for the terrain. The parts understood our relationship to the whole, and that, in turn, makes democratic governance possible. The town meetings had another benefit. They equipped us to deal more handily with the problems that did emerge. In the science of social mapping, the definition of a community is a set of nodes that are densely interconnected. My friends form a community if they all don't know just me, but also have independent relationships with one another. Communication builds stronger community. Ultimately, democracy works only if we citizens are capable of thinking beyond our narrow self-interest. But to do so, we need a shared view of the world we cohabit. We need to come into contact with other people's lives and needs and desires. The filter bubble pushes us in the opposite direction. It creates the impression that our narrow self-interest is all that exists. And while this is great for getting people to shop online, it's not great for getting people to make better decisions together. The primary difficulty of democracy, John Dewey wrote, is that of discovering the means by which a scattered, mobile, and manifold public may so recognize itself as to define and express its interests. In the early days of the Internet, this was one of the medium's great hopes, that it would finally offer a medium whereby whole towns, and indeed countries, could co-create their culture through discourse. Personalization has given us something very different. A public sphere sorted and manipulated by algorithms, fragmented by design, and hostile to dialogue. Which begs an important question. Why would the engineers who designed these systems want to build them this way? 6. Hello, world! Socrates. Or again, in a ship, if a man having the power to do what he likes has no intelligence or skill in navigation, Erites Cybernetikes, do you see what will happen to him and to his fellow sailors? Plato. First Alcibiades, the earliest known use of the word cybernetics. It's the first fragment of code in the codebook, the thing every aspiring programmer learns on day one. Although the code differs from language to language, the result is the same. A single line of text against a stark white screen. Hello, world! A god's greeting to his invention, or perhaps an invention's greeting to its god. The delight you experience is electric. The current of creation running through your fingers into the keypad, into the machine, and back out into the world. It's alive! That every programmer's career begins with "Hello, world," is not a coincidence. It's the power to create new universes which is what often draws people to code in the first place. Type in a few lines, or a few thousand, strike a key, and something seems to come to life on your screen. A new space unfolds, a new engine roars. If you're clever enough, you can make and manipulate anything you can imagine. We are as gods, wrote futurist Stuart Brand on the cover of his Whole Earth catalog in 1968, and we might as well get good at it. Brand's catalog, which sprang out of the Back to the Land movement, was a favorite among California's emerging class of programmers and computer enthusiasts. In Brand's view, tools and technologies turned people, normally at the mercy of their environments, into gods in control of them. And the computer was a tool that could become any tool at all. Brand's impact on the culture of Silicon Valley and geekdom is hard to overestimate. Though he wasn't a programmer himself, his vision shaped the Silicon Valley worldview. As Fred Turner details in the fascinating From Counterculture to Cyberculture, Brand and his cadre of do-it-yourself futurists were disaffected hippies, social revolutionaries who were uncomfortable with the communes sprouting up in Haight-Ashbury. Rather than seeking to build a new world through political change, which required wading through the messiness of compromise and group decision-making, they set out to build a world on their own. In Hackers, his groundbreaking history of the rise of engineering culture, Steve Levy points out that this ideal spread from the programmers themselves to the users each time some user flicked the machine on and the screen came alive with words, thoughts, pictures, and sometimes elaborate worlds built out of air, those computer programs which could make any man, or woman, a god. In the era described by Levy's book, the term hacker didn't have the transgressive, law-breaking connotations it acquired later. The God impulse is at the root of many creative professions. Artists conjure up color-flecked landscapes. Novelists build whole societies on paper. But it's always clear that these are creations. A painting doesn't talk back. A program can, and the illusion that it's real is powerful. Eliza, one of the first rudimentary AI programs, was programmed with a battery of therapist-like questions and some basic contextual cues. But students spent hours talking to it about their deepest problems. "I'm having some troubles with my family," a student might write, and Eliza would immediately respond, "Tell me more about your family." Especially for people who've been socially ostracized due to quirks or brains or both, there are at least two strong draws to the world-building impulse. When social life is miserable or oppressive, escapism is a reasonable response. It's probably not coincidental that role-playing games, sci-fi and fantasy literature, and programming often go together. The infinitely expandable universe of code provides a second benefit: complete power over your domain. "We all fantasize about living without rules," says Siva Vaidyanathan. "We imagine the Adam Sandler movie where you can move around and take people's clothes off. If you don't think of reciprocity as one of the beautiful and rewarding things about being a human being, you wish for a place or a way of acting without consequence. When the rules of high school social life seem arbitrary and oppressive, the allure of making your own rules is pretty powerful." This approach works pretty well as long as you're the sole denizen of your creation, but like the God of Genesis, coders quickly get lonely. They build portals into their homespun worlds, allowing others to enter. And that's where things get complicated. On the one hand, the more inhabitants in the world you've built, the more power you have. But on the other hand, the citizens can get uppity. The programmer wants to set up some rules to either a game or a system, and then let it run without interference from anything, says Douglas Rushkoff, an early cyber booster turned cyber pragmatist. If you have a program that needs a minder to come in and help it run, then it's not a very good program, is it? It's supposed to just run. Coders sometimes harbor God impulses. They sometimes even have aspirations to revolutionize society, but they almost never aspire to be politicians. While programming is considered a transparent, neutral, highly controllable realm, where production results in immediate gratification and something useful, writes NYU anthropologist Gabriella Coleman, politics tends to be seen by programmers as buggy, mediated, tainted action clouded by ideology that is not productive of much of anything. There's some merit to that view, of course, but for programmers to shun politics completely is a problem, because increasingly, given the disputes that inevitably arise when people come together, the most powerful ones will be required to adjudicate and to govern. Before we get to how this blind spot affects our lives, though, it's worth looking at how engineers think. The Empire of Clever. Imagine that you're a smart high school student on the low end of the social totem pole. You're alienated from adult authority, but unlike many teenagers, you're also alienated from the power structures of your peers, an existence that can feel lonely and peripheral. Systems and equations are intuitive, but people aren't. Social signals are confusing and messy, difficult to interpret. Then you discover code. You may be powerless at the lunch table, but code gives you power over an infinitely malleable world and opens the door to a symbolic system that's perfectly clear and ordered. The jostling for position and status fades away. The nagging parental voices disappear. There's just a clean, white page for you to fill, an opportunity to build a better place, a home, from the ground up. No wonder you're a geek. This isn't to say that geeks and software engineers are friendless or even socially inept, but there's an implicit promise in becoming a coder. Apprentice yourself to symbolic systems, learn to carefully understand the rules that govern them, and you'll gain power to manipulate them. The more powerless you feel, the more appealing this promise becomes. Hacking, Stephen Levy writes, gave you not only an understanding of the system, but an addictive control as well, along with the illusion that total control was just a few features away. As anthropologist Coleman points out, beyond the jocks and nerd stereotypes, there are actually many different geek cultures. There are open software advocates, most famously embodied by Linux founder Linus Torvalds, who spend untold hours collaboratively building free software tools for the masses, and there are Silicon Valley startup entrepreneurs. There are anti-spam zealots, who organize online posses to seek out and shut down Viagra purveyors. And then there's the more antagonistic wing, spammers. Trolls, who spend their time looking for fun ways to leverage technology at others' expense. Freaks, who are animated by the challenge to break open telecommunication systems. And hackers, who break into government systems to prove it can be done. Generalizations that span these different niches and communities run the risk of stereotyping and tend to fall short. But at the heart of these subcultures is a shared method for looking at and asserting power in the world, which influences how and why online software is made. The through line is a focus on systemization. Nearly all geek cultures are structured as an empire of clever, wherein ingenuity, not charisma, is king. The intrinsic efficiency of a creation is more important than how it looks. Geek cultures are data-driven and reality-based, valuing substance over style. Humor plays a prominent role. As Coleman points out, jokes demonstrate an ability to manipulate language in the same way that an elegant solution to a tricky programming problem demonstrates mastery over code. The fact that humor also often serves to unmask the ridiculous pieties of the powerful is undoubtedly also part of its appeal. Systemization is especially alluring because it doesn't offer power just in the virtual sphere. It can also provide a way to understand and navigate social situations. I learned this firsthand when, as an awkward 17-year-old with all the trappings of geek experience, the fantasy books, the introversion, the obsession with HTML and BBSs, I flew across the country to accept the wrong job. In a late junior year panic, I'd applied for every internship I could find. One group, a nuclear disarmament organization based in San Francisco, had gotten back to me, and without much further investigation, I'd signed up. It was only when I walked into the office that I realized I'd signed up to be a canvasser. Off the top of my head, I couldn't imagine a worse fit, but because I had no other prospects, I decided to stick out the day of training. Canvassing, the trainer explained, was a science as much as an art, and the laws were powerful. Make eye contact. Explain why the issue matters to you, and after you ask for money, let your target say the first thing. I was intrigued. Asking people for money was scary, but the briefing hinted at a hidden logic. I committed the rules to memory. When I walked through my first grassy Palo Alto lawn, my heart was in my throat. Here I was at the doorstep of someone I'd never met, asking for $50. The door opened, and a harried woman with long gray hair peeped out. I took a deep breath and launched into my spiel. I asked. I waited. And then she nodded and went to get her checkbook. The euphoria I felt wasn't about the $50. It was about something bigger. The promise that the chaos of human social life could be reduced to rules that I could understand, follow, and master. Conversation with strangers had never come naturally to me. I didn't know what to talk about. But the hidden logic of getting someone I'd never met to trust me with $50 had to be the tip of a larger iceberg. By the end of a summer traipsing through the yards of Palo Alto and Marin, I was a master canvasser. Systemization is a great method for building functional software, and the quantitative scientific approach to social observation has given us many great insights into human phenomena as well. Dan Ariely researches the predictably irrational decisions we make on a daily basis. His findings help us make better decisions. The blog at OKCupid.com, a math-driven dating website, identifies patterns in the emails flying back and forth between people to make them better daters. Howdy is a better opener than hi. But there are dangers in taking the method too far. As I discussed in Chapter 5, the most human acts are often the most unpredictable ones. Because systematizing works much of the time, it's easy to believe that by reducing and brute forcing an understanding of any system, you can control it. And as a master of a self-created universe, it's easy to start to view people as a means to an end, as variables to be manipulated on a mental spreadsheet, rather than as breathing, thinking beings. It's difficult both to systematize and to appeal to the fullness of human life, its unpredictability, emotionality, and surprising quirks, at the same time. David Gelertner, a Yale computer scientist, barely survived an encounter with an explosive package sent by the Unabomber. His eyesight and right hand are permanently damaged as a result. But Gelertner is hardly the technological utopian Ted Kaczynski believed him to be. When you do something in the public sphere, Gelertner told a reporter, it behooves you to know something about what the public sphere is like. How did this country get this way? What was the history of the relationship between technology and the public? What's the history of political exchange? The problem is, hackers don't tend to know any of that. And that's why it worries me to have these people in charge of public policy. Not because they're bad, just because they're uneducated. Understanding the rules that govern a messy, complex world make it intelligible and navigable. But systemizing inevitably involves a trade-off. Rules give you some control, but you lose nuance and texture, a sense of deeper connection. And when a strict systematizing sensibility entirely shapes social space, as it often does online, the results aren't always pretty.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.